Coming up, I got six thoughts following game six of the Western Conference Finals with the Spurs tying things up. Another blowout victory over the Oklahoma City Thunder. And then later in the show, got Nate Ament, potential top 10 pick in the 26 NBA draft, joining me for a really great conversation. Had a good time with him, and I think you'll learn a lot about his game and what it could mean moving forward in the NBA. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show, everybody. We just watched a game six blowout between the Thunder and the Spurs. San Antonio wins this one 118-91. This has been a series of blowouts. I got six thoughts from game six as we approach game seven now. Also going to talk about some of the latest news around the NBA as well. Number one thought on my mind here, is SGA hurt or has he just been figured out? Earlier in the series, after game four, we showed a graphic on the screen, and here's an updated version of that. Looking at his shot distribution in the series when Victor Wembanyama has been on the floor, it's been cut in half pretty much with him getting to the rim. As you can see with your eyeballs watching games, 12% of SGA shots come at the rim compared to 24% the rest of the postseason. 9% in the paint, non-restricted, with Wemby on the floor, 17% rest of the entire postseason. Where that change is experienced is they're turning him into more of a mid-range shooter. 58% of SGA shots come from mid-range when Wemby's on the floor compared to only 38% in all of the situations. That is the Wemby influence. That is on what the Spurs are doing and how they're defending him. But what's interesting is just how poorly SGA is shooting the ball on the series. He's 36% from the mid-range, 24 out of 67 after tonight's game six. He was 0 for 5 from 3 tonight, his worst shooting game of the series from 3. He's now 6 for 23 from 3 in the entire series, 26%. If Shea isn't hitting these pull-up jumpers at the rate that we know he can, he had some of the most miraculous pull-up, step-back, sidestep three-pointers during the regular season that we've seen. We know he's one of the greatest mid-range shooters, really, in the history of basketball. It's just the factual thing. He's well over 55% on pull-ups, and so many of those are heavily contested. But in this series, he's been absolutely contained. Is that, like I said, has he been figured out by the Spurs? Is this purely their ability to keep him out of the paint, throw him off rhythm with Castle and Vassell bothering his shot? Or is this something with his hands? We've seen wraps on his fingers. Is there something affecting him, causing him to be so efficient? Regardless, it's undoubtedly one of the keys to the series here, considering we're talking about a two-time MVP here, and he's shooting 36% from mid-range and 26% from three. And we're entering a game seven now. A two-time MVP might blow a 3-2 lead. This is a legacy moment for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. The Michael Jordans, the Kobe Bryants, those guys figure it out in these situations where they can't get to the shots that they want to get to, when they're facing a defense that turns them into something that they don't want to be. SGA loves the mid-range, but not taking basically two-thirds of his shots from that area of the floor. I look forward to seeing how he performs in Game 7. I thought maybe this would be the finally SGA plays a great game moment of the series, but it wasn't. So we'll see if it happens in Game 7. Number two, was bringing Jalen Williams back a bad idea? Minus 18 in 10 minutes, 1 point on one shot, two turnovers, non-factor on defense. Looked like he was doing cardio out there. Maybe all of this is worth it. He'll be back to looking like Jalen Williams in game seven, but this was only his fifth game in 51 days. So it's understandable if you're looking like you're just doing cardio out there and not making the impact that you'd expect from an all-NBA guy. But I thought he looked like crap. And that was one of the reasons why this next question, it was a real thing for the San Antonio Spurs. How the hell did the Spurs win the Kornet minutes? They were minus 9 in game 1, minus 10 in game 2, minus 18 in game 3, minus 9 in game 4, minus 6 in game 5, and then plus 13 in game 6. part of that was because about half of those minutes came with J-Dub on the floor and he was just a non-factor. But the real primary reason was the Spurs paired basically all of the Cornette minutes with Dylan Harper. Dylan Harper was on the floor for 13 of Cornette's 14 minutes, and he was unbelievable. He looked absolutely sensational tonight. This was the future star version of Dylan Harper that I think people came to expect before this recent dip with a few off games, getting stripped by Cason Wallace twice in game five, Alex Caruso stealing the ball from him as well. It looked like he had issues with his handle at times, but tonight, this looked like the Harper who got to the rim at will. And I thought that was symbolic of the Spurs play as a whole. They just played with complete aggression right from the jump, driving into the paint, getting the ball to the middle of the floor. And Harper was better at that than anybody on the floor tonight. And tonight for the game, I think with Dylan Harper, you know, 18 points off the bench on 6 of 9, he had 4 assists, only 1 turnover, 6 boards in the game. Just the energy looked more like the Dylan Harper that we saw in past rounds where I'm out here apologizing for picking Conn Knipple over Dylan Harper. This was the guy who looks like a future All-NBA guy. We saw that version of him tonight. And as I said, I think that attacking mentality was really, it's been the key to the series as a whole. The team that comes out and plays more aggressive, plays more their style, more with energy and force, that's been one of the stories. Tonight was obviously San Antonio, and what that has led to is blowouts. Fourth question, is this just going to be a series of blowouts? Is that what we're going to watch here? Game one obviously was a double overtime epic, one of the best games of the entire year. Game two was pretty good, 9-point game. It was competitive. Game three, OKC by 15. Game four, Spurs by 21. Game five, OKC by 13. Game six, Spurs by 27. Is that what it's going to be? Or are we going to get a game seven where both of these teams are going full throttle and we get one of those down-to-the-wire epic games? That's what I'm hoping for, obviously. And if you're a Spurs fan, you're hoping for a Spurs blow. If you're a Thunder fan, you're hoping for a Thunder blowout. But I hope for everybody else, all the other fans of every other team, I hope we get an epic down-to-the-wire, another overtime game with some theatrics. That would be pretty awesome. And looking ahead to that game seven on Saturday night, I'm very excited. Clear out your calendar, folks. You got your Saturday night plans already. Who's going to be the swing player? Because tonight, Spurs win by 27. De'Aaron Fox is 1 from 9. He still struggled again. He still looks like he's playing on 1 foot out there. Is Fox able to have a De'Aaron Fox-esque game? Alex Caruso in the series, he has scored in each game 31, 17, 15, 0, 22, and 7 points tonight in game six. We have seen wild swings from some of OKC's role players, Jared McCain included, who was sensational in game five with an unbelievable third quarter. Tonight, only 4 of 11, 13 points, a pretty middling performance, had some sloppy turnovers, I felt like, too, in that first half. I mentioned Jalen Williams, J-Dub, on the OKC side earlier. Is he going to look more like himself? Dylan Harper, talked about him already, 18 points in game six. He had 5 in game five, 4 in game four, 6 in game three. Look back to game one, he had 24 in that game. Who is going to be these X factors in this game seven? Historically, these are the guys that tend to win these games. And I don't know what to expect, honestly, because it has been a series of one game, one team blows the other team out. Then the other team bounces back and blows them out again. And the story just flips the other way. And naturally, that might make you think, okay, this is going to be an OKC blowout. They're back at home. They're going to have the crowd behind them. They're going to have the friendly rims, the friendly bounces. Everything's going to go that way. But not so fast, my friend. We saw game one. We saw what happened in game one, and who knows if we're going to get another game like that, because that leads to my sixth thought following game six. What version of Victor Wembanyama do we get? We saw a 4-rebound version of Wemby in game five where he gets ripped, and he looked like, frankly, he did look like a 7'7" guard in that game. He did. But tonight, the dude came to play. He came with serious aggression right out of the gate, walking in the tunnel. What was he wearing? Was that like a one of his monk outfits? Was that an alien outfit? I don't know what that was exactly, but he came with the shaved head. And like it was, what do the kids call it these days? An aura gamble? Is that what that was? An aura gamble? And he gambled and he won big tonight? That's what I'm pretty sure we just witnessed from Victor Wembanyama, because the dude, I mean, God. Right away, early in the game, the intensity on defense, the tone setting. They showed the video of him as a leader in the huddle before the game, looking at everybody in their eye. How is a guy only in his third year that much of a leader already? Like, you can't help but respect it. I mean, the fact he's so young and at 22 years old and already he has demanded the respect of that entire locker room. Obviously, the game 5 clip of him rallying his team when they were down 20, it didn't work. But tonight in game 6, certainly that team came out just fighting. I can't wait for game 7, guys. We like, what a blessing. We get a game 7 between the Thunder and the Spurs. I can only hope that this ends up one of those epic finishes to the series. Cause frankly, I mean, like game 1 was amazing. Game 2 was solid. Most of these other games have just been blowouts. And that's interesting when you zoom out and look at the series from a game-to-game perspective with how things have gone. But on the night of, I wish we had an epic down-to-the-wire game to talk about. And I hope that's what we get in Game 7. And I feel like it's going to build towards that. I think this is the type of series you're seeing haymakers get thrown towards each side in every single game. I think game 7, we're going to see these teams bring their best, and I can't wait. I can't wait for Saturday night. I'm fired up already. I wish we could fast forward to game 7 already and then to the finals next week on Wednesday night. I'm very excited to head to either San Antonio or Oklahoma City, wherever it's going to be. There's some other news in the NBA today. If you missed it, I had a Knicks podcast earlier on Thursday with CP, the franchise from Knicks Fan TV, and Jonathan Macri from Knicks Film School. And we had an awesome hour-long conversation talking about the Knicks, talking about how they got here, all the years of suffering, what's changed in the postseason. We also got into how the Knicks match up against both San Antonio and New York, and obviously we also got into, as every Knicks fan is pissed off at me for, not having Jalen Brunson on my all-NBA teams. Look, Maxie was better during the regular season. I probably should have had Brunson over Denny Avdia and Jalen Johnson, though. I made that mistake, as we talked about to open the show. They grilled me on that. It was a very fun conversation, so make sure to check that out if you haven't already. And later in today's show, I got Nate Amen, potential top 10 pick in the 2026 NBA draft as well, and great conversation with him. Anyway, the Knicks, after that recording earlier today, news came out that Mitchell Robinson broke his right pinky finger with no timetable for his return. First thought is, I mean, it's not like he can shoot any worse. I mean, if he's going to get hacked, it's not going to matter. But it obviously does matter in every other regard. He is a lob threat. He offers something different for Jalen Brunson as a screener in the pick and roll. Cat can pop, can short roll, can roll as well to the basket. But Mitchell Robinson offers that screening and rolling gravity. That's a different differentiation for the Knicks. And that's one of the things that's been key to their success this postseason and really their entire regular season as a 3 seed in the East. The ability to play with different lineups, just with Mitchell Robinson, just with Cat, sometimes with both. And I think regardless of the matchup in the NBA Finals, whether it's Oklahoma City or San Antonio, I was already thinking maybe we're going to see Mike Brown pull this out. Maybe you're going to see too big for a 5-minute stretch or a 10-minute stretch or a 1-minute stretch to close a quarter. And if Mitchell Robinson's out or limited, I don't feel quite as good about doing that with Huck Porty. I will see, obviously, who wins this series, OKC or San Antonio. But I think this could end up being a pretty big story if he's going to miss time. And we'll see how it transpires, though, in the days to come. But that is definitely something to monitor. Other news today in the NBA draft, 38 players withdrew from the 2026 NBA draft, and that includes 11 of my top 65. So my big board and mock draft will be updated next week on Yahoo Sports. We're going to do a new mock draft. I'll have one here on my podcast and on YouTube as well. I'm excited to do that because there's going to be some new names in there. We got to update with some more players, some more faces, because Tunde Yesufu, Billy Richmond, Amari Allen, Tyler Tanner, Milan Momcilovic, Matt Abel, Andre Stojakovic, Malachi Marino, Baidungu, Chiyuwenle, Tobiasen, 11 guys in my top 65 are gone, going back to college. The interesting one is Momcilovic. Everybody else chose their school, like Matt Abel is transferring to North Carolina. We got Yesufu transferring to St. John's. Momcilovic still in the transfer portal. Unknown if he's going to go back to Iowa State or another school, possibly for a massive bag, reportedly near $6, $7 million. That's crazy. But hey, best shooter in the nation, going to soon be next year one of the best shooters in the NBA. That is well-deserved for him. The big news today, interesting timing, the NBA dropping, having this vote on the day of Game 6 of the Western Conference Finals, but lottery reform has been approved. And there are a couple new things in there that haven't been previously leaked out over the past month since the 3-2 lottery system was first revealed. Just a quick review for people who might be unfamiliar with the 3-2-1 lottery system. We are moving from 14 to 16 teams. Those two additional teams are going to be the loser of the 7-8 play-in game. So that team is going to receive one lottery ball, because with the 3-2-1 lottery system, the way it's going to work is there's a relegation zone for the bottom three teams. If you're in the bottom three of the league, you get only two balls in the lottery. The teams that finish 4th to 10th of worst record are going to get three balls, which comes with roughly an 8% chance of landing the number one pick. The next group of teams is going to receive two balls, the same amount as the bottom three teams. And then those play-in teams I already mentioned are going to receive one. The NBA is going to draft or draw for all 16 of these picks. The bottom three teams can only fall as far as to number 12. Every other team can land everywhere else. So there is going to be a hell of a lot of randomness in the draft lottery for the next 3 years, because that's what the NBA has decided to do. This is a three-year trial for the 2027, 2028, and 2029 drafts. And then after that, they're going to reevaluate and figure out what they want to do. But we are going to get some crazy draft lottery results. And what's we learned today, and this is very interesting for a few different reasons, we learned that the NBA is going to reverse the order of the top 16 for the second round. This is interesting because let's say, for example, you end up with the 16th pick and you also own your second round pick. That means your pick in the second round is going to go to 31. You're going to have the first pick in the second round. So one of the criticisms of the 3-2-1 lottery system has been, does it create incentive to tank at the edge of the playoffs now, an even greater incentive? Because if you look at the lottery odds, the way they break down, if you're the sixth seed and you don't feel like you have any shot of making it, to make a playoff run, you might rather lose a few games towards the end of the year, get into the 9 spot, drop out of that, and hey, you get a 5.4% chance of getting the number one pick, and you get a really good chance as well of just landing in the top 5 or landing the 8th pick or the 9th pick, because they draw all 16 of them. And that's the big difference this year. And not only that, if you still land number 16, guess what? You also would get the 31st pick. And so there's a greater incentive now to be in the lottery. And that's something that's a bit unexpected that was not previously discussed, at least publicly. I'm sure internally teams talked about it, but nobody had reported about it. I personally had not heard it myself. And I've been ahead on reporting a lot of this over the past month with the 3-2-1 lottery, among everything last week with the Memphis Grizzlies. As we talked about on my podcast earlier in the week, they ended up getting screwed. The NBA did move forward with the retroactive decision with the no top five picks in 3 years in a row, no number one picks 2 years in a row. So that means the Wizards cannot receive the number one pick in 2027 because they are going retroactive to this year. And that means the Grizzlies, because they own the rights to an unprotected Jazz pick that they got back for Jaren Jackson Jr., are not allowed to have that pick land in the top five, because they're going back 2 years to 2025. The NBA voted overwhelmingly in favor of this, 29-1. One team didn't vote in favor of it. No surprise, the Memphis Grizzlies voted against it, because effectively, from an arbitrary decision, the NBA has changed a unprotected pick to a top five protected pick. And that was one of the key assets they got back for Jaren Jackson Jr. So understandably so, they are furious about it, and all their fans are furious about it. But I think for the league overall, this should be an upgrade. Should be. We'll see. I mean, I'm a bit thrown aback by that second round reversal thingamajiggy that they added in there, because man, like, that does create a little bit more incentive for those teams on the edges of the lottery to say, we're the 11 seed right now. We see no reason to fight for the 10 seed or the 9 seed. We'll just keep our three lottery balls instead of downgrading to two. Oh, we're the 8 seed right now. Let's slide down to the 9-10, because then we get an additional ball. Teams are going to try things out, and that's where it's going to get fascinating these next 3 years, with the powers this vote has granted Adam Silver. Adam Silver is going to have the power, if he perceives a team's choices as tanking, to change their draft slot, change their lottery odds, impose significant fines greater than we've ever seen for tanking. And that's what's going to be interesting here, because from my conversations with the league office and with people around the league working for different teams, people with different perspectives of draft lottery reform, what's been pretty consistent is people saying the goal from owners and the goal from teams is to stomp out tanking. And so I think that's why they wanted the top five protection rule. That's why they don't want consecutive years with number one picks going to the same team. That's why they're giving Adam Silver more power. That said, there's still flaws in it. I mean, like, for example, the Wizards can still get the number one pick if they trade for somebody else's. The Jazz, with their pick going to the Grizzlies, their own pick can't go in the top five, which hurts Memphis, but they can still land in the top five for the third year in a row if they use it with somebody else's pick. So that there's some issues with it, and I still personally think they shouldn't have done the protections for the top five 3 years in a row. I think it's too extreme. I've heard it referred to as the Spurs rule. Multiple people have called that to me, the Spurs rule, because they don't want a team to be able to get Victor Wembanyama with the first pick, Stephon Castle with the fourth pick, and then Dylan Harper with the second pick 3 years in a row. But you can still land in the top five 3 years in a row if you have somebody else's pick. I think it's silly. I think it's over the top. But overall, I'm very excited about the 3-1 lottery. Don't get me wrong with some of my questions. I feel like I'm hopefully being fair about this with some of my concerns and skepticisms about the choices that they made. But overall, tanking is an abomination. And this year, with a third of the league not caring about winning games and sometimes outright trying to lose, that does hurt the game as a whole. That hurts the product when you tune in any night of the week and watch a game. It hurts evaluation. Brad Stevens said it during his Celtics exit interview. A third of the league was not trying to win. Maybe this wasn't the best year to evaluate teams and individual talent. It's going to be better if everybody's trying to win, but there's no guarantee that the 3-2-1 lottery is actually going to accomplish that at all levels. But I do think it is certainly going to help, and that does have me feeling quite optimistic about what it could become. Got a question in the live chat from Regulator 9268. Do you think it's unfair for teams like the Bucks trying to trade superstars now after a decade of winning and you can't tank as easily? Then when trying to trade, you don't even know what the rule is. Yeah, and that's one of the flaws. I've had a number of executives reach out to me and say, I don't really want to trade picks after 2030 if we don't know what the system's going to look like. And the reason being is like the Memphis example is a real example of what could happen to other teams. There's been 40 plus unprotected first round draft picks that have already been dealt. And a lot of those are going to be affected by these new odds, just straight up the new odds. Forget about the no streaks, the no number ones 2 years in a row, no top five, three years in a row. The streaks change the value of these selections, of these traded picks. And nobody could have known it was coming. And that's one of the issues I take with the NBA. They released a quote saying how we warn teams before the draft lottery that this could happen. Yeah, but you didn't warn teams before the trade deadline or last year or the year before. And to your point, Regulator, it does put teams trying to rebuild now in a very interesting position. That said, like I said on my Knicks podcast earlier today with Macri and CP, I do think the Knicks, you can say they're a big market team. I don't think that's relevant to this conversation. The Knicks proved how to build a team through trades, through smart signings, through risky decisions, through having courage and balls when it comes to making these tough choices that every franchise faces. Some owners are afraid of making big moves. Some owners would have said, no, we're not trading two-time All-NBA player Julius Randle for Karl Anthony Towns, who's a softie. Some teams would have said, Jalen Brunson's not worth the risk. He's only shown stuff in small sample sizes. We're not trading five first-round picks for Mikal Bridges. We're not going all in. Some owners would do that. Some owners would be complacent. And some front offices would be afraid of losing their jobs by taking a risk. I think the Knicks serve as an example of how teams are going to have to build in this new era. Because the lottery is going to be random. It's just like, you can look at the odds all you want. It's random. And so that's where I think the NBA is betting that these odds are flat enough that teams won't feel too much incentive to jump from the back end of the play-in into the next zone. Or, you know what I mean? I think that's sort of what they're thinking. But ultimately, I do think it puts a team like the Bucks into an even tougher position, and that's just unfortunate timing. I mean, unfortunately it is. Moose asked, KOC, how did the officiating crew do tonight? I thought they did great and should be brought back Saturday night. Yeah, I'd love to see this crew back. I thought they did a good job as well. To me, to my eyeballs, it felt fair. I thought both teams were allowed to play with aggression. OKC just played with a lot less of it than San Antonio did in tonight's game. So I think it's a bit overblown. I think it's a shame that the officials have dominated the conversation around this series. I think it has just been a series of swings back and forth, haymaker on one side, haymaker on the other side. And that's the way I feel about it. I know a hell of a lot of people clearly disagree with me, considering the way in which the series has been talked about ad nauseum by the public, especially regarding SGA and the flopping and falling. And it is extreme, but there's a little bit of a thunder derangement syndrome here when it comes to OKC. Thank you so much, Regulator. I appreciate that very much. Guys, today was a very busy day. I had a podcast recording with Nate Ament, who is a potential top 10 pick in the 2026 NBA draft. And I'll tell you what, like, I was really impressed by him. I saw him work out in the morning, and like, one on zero workouts are not a big deal. I mean, he's shooting around, he's dribbling the ball and all that type of stuff. But I think the size in person, he's a legit 6'10". To me, it looks like he's now weighs 210. I think he's somebody who can even add a bit more muscle over time. That's one of the things we talked about. And, you know, my conversations in recent days with executives, phone calls, text conversations and everything like that. My main takeaway is this, and we got a long way to go still to the draft. It is May 28th. As I say this now, it's almost midnight Eastern, about to be May 29th. So we're a little over 3 weeks away from the draft. My main impression from talking to people around the league is that don't expect things to be the way they appear to be. And by that, I mean the number four pick with the Chicago Bulls, for example. Don't assume it's going to be Caleb Wilson. It's probably going to be Caleb Wilson, but don't assume it is. I interviewed Michael Brown earlier in the week, and he said how the Utah Jazz are working him out. Why are the Utah Jazz working him out? Not to think of number two, but maybe to trade down? Like, what if they view Michael Brown as the second best player in the draft, and they know they can get him fifth or sixth or seventh? You trade down, just like Danny Ainge did when he was in Boston, when they thought Tatum was the best player in the draft, and they got him third. So I say all that to say that's been one of the key topics of conversation with people in recent days. How could this board change? Where could there be surprises? Who could go higher than people anticipate? Nate Amendt being one of them, 6'10", formerly like the third or fourth ranked player out of high school, entering college when he had an up and down year, as we talked about in depth. Adai Mara, is there a team in the top 10 that's like, we need a big to battle Wemby? We need a 7'3", 300-pound guy with skill. I mean, how can you not watch this postseason right now and think, yeah, let's get it done with 175-pound LeBaron Filon? And I like Filon, but my God, like, you got to be – Brunson's 190, 195 and tough and strong. I don't know if LeBaron Filon is going to be able to put 20 pounds on himself there. I think Adai Mara is going to go higher than people think. I think there's a chance Nate Amendt does. I think there's a chance Kareem Lopez does. I think there's a chance Yaxel Lendenborg does. I think there's a chance Merez Johnson does. I think a lot of people around the league watching these playoffs have those same questions. So, hey, that's one of the main thoughts on my mind. Take it for what you want. Things can change. It very well might go chalk. One AJ, two Darren, three Cam Boozer, four Caleb Wilson. But things could change in the weeks to come. And one of those guys who could swing things in this draft process is Nate Amendt, freshman out of Tennessee. For the audio listeners, that conversation is coming up next. For the YouTube audience watching me live right here on YouTube, thank you guys for tuning in late tonight. It was a very fun day. I drove all the way from New York City to come home to watch the end of this game and record it, talk to you guys. And hey, I hope you enjoy the rest of your week. I believe we'll be back live again after game seven. Hopefully we'll be able to have Tom Haverstraw on the show on game seven. Always good to chat with Tom. Hey, hope you enjoyed game six. Talk to you on Saturday night for game seven. Game seven. Have a good night, everybody. Talk to you soon. Coming up, my interview with Nate Amendt, potential top 10 pick in the 2026 NBA draft. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Today, a very special guest, Nate Amendt, potential top 10 pick in the 2026 NBA draft. Nate, how you doing?
I'm good. Good to be here.
Saw you training this morning at the gym here in New York City and shooting threes, playing inside, handling the ball, showing off your versatility. How would you describe your game to somebody who has literally never seen you play before? They don't know who you are. What's the self-scouting report you'd give?
I would say just that versatility, like being able to do anything on the offensive side, but also being able to switch and guard any position on the defensive side.
Okay, so you're somebody, what's your height? Well, like size-wise,
for the description. I'm like 6'9", 210 mm-hmm. runner.
Okay, 210, and you were 190 entering the year at Tennessee, right?
I was 185 my senior year of high school.
Okay, so you've gained a lot in the past year or so. Yeah. This past year at Tennessee, what's the biggest thing you've learned that you think is like a lesson that you've taken that's not viewed in the box score?
Oof. That's a good one. I think probably the biggest thing is kind of just what separates good players from great players. Like the mentality part of basketball it's like 90% of the game, honestly. And that's why you see like the greats like Kobe, MJ, LeBron, they have elite level mindsets. And that's kind of what separates, you know, good NBA players from great ones. And that's kind of something I've been trying to work to implement into my game.
And one of your best stretches of the year came in the middle of January to middle of February. You're averaging like 23 points per game, near 40% from three. That was after a slow start to the year. What was different for you during that stretch? What was clicking?
Yeah. I think I just stopped thinking so much, just stopped, you know, putting too much pressure on myself to succeed, and just kind of playing more off instincts, just going out there and doing what I know how to do. And obviously, you know, coach put more trust in me and everything like that. But for me, it was just going out there and playing, not thinking about anything else but that.
Well, from that stretch of games where you were playing at your best, what do you think was your best game or your best moment that you had?
I would probably say the Alabama game at Alabama.
For me, that came to mind.
Yeah, yeah. That one was a lot of fun for sure, especially, you know, rivals and stuff like that.
You're living in the mid-range that game.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that kind of the formula for you?
Yeah, it is. And it's something I wasn't really, like, used to going into Tennessee. I don't know if you watched, but at Tennessee, we played like, two bigs in the paint. So Coach Barnes' message to me was just get to your spot and raise over a defender, because when you go into the paint, you're going to find trouble with, like, four guys in the paint. So his message and what we worked on a lot during that year was just getting to my spot, raising over and shooting it.
Now, you're somebody who you can shoot threes a lot, mm-hmm. got into the mid-range a lot in that game, pull-ups, face-up opportunities. Like, sometimes you looked like a 6'10", kind of point, like power forward, mm-hmm. kind of a classic throwback mm-hmm. in some ways in the moments of that game. I'm curious for you, what do you view as the value of the mid-range in your game rather than just, like, spot-up threes?
Yeah, I mean, it's huge, honestly. You see it now, like with players with Shea, KD, like those guys live in the mid range. I think it's such an easy shot once you get to your spot. Like once you get super close to the rim, especially like coming into the league and you got players like Wemby and all these footers. I think just the closer you can get to the rim, the closer your shot can get to the rim, the easier it's going to be. I mean, also, I think that's just better for like, in a sense, just like for your career. Like you don't see Shea battling with bigs trying to get to the rim, that he gets to a spot and shoots over him. So he's able to play longer and like not risk injuries.
I mean, you mentioned like rim protectors around the basket, like Wemby. You're seeing like Isaiah Hartenstein take that kind of sky floater, and SGA having a pull up from mid range, not getting to the basket as often. So it's usually, I think, an end game star tool, right, for a lot of guys. But it seems like in certain matchups, it's literally anybody needs to have that shot now, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was actually at the I went to an OKC game versus Spurs, and seeing like his floaters and kind of using those tools, because you know the league's changing, especially with someone like Victor, who's just altering every shot at the rim. So you got to be kind of careful and on 10 toes every time you get in there.
Now, I was sleuthing on Instagram mm-hmm. and I saw a photo of you in the crowd with a fan who took it and your tagged photos. So I realized you were at that OKC game. Does that mean there was a Thunder workout?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, interesting. Were there anybody else at that workout, or was it one on no?
It was a one on no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I see. How did that go?
It was good. Super hard, but you know, it was good.
Really? Well, in what ways was that hard with OKC?
I mean, usually with any NBA team you work out for, especially if it's one on no, because they don't have anyone up there to match you up with, they're gonna like test your conditioning, test your like mental strength and your ability to pick up new concepts on the fly. So that's kind of what it was. But just like super tough endurance wise.
That's like a concept they tested you on.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it was reading closeouts, understanding the game. It's OKC specific, like they already have their main creators and stuff like that. So being able to learn how to play off them, quick decisions, 1-2 dribbles, shooting when there's a short closeout and driving when it's a hard closeout.
I feel like with you, that's like one of your skill sets. You can shoot, spot out, pass. You have these, you know, fundamental skills as a baseline for what you can be in the NBA. With the shooting, that is something obviously of critical importance in today's league. Absolutely. Start of the year for you at Tennessee, you shot 27% from three over your first 18 or so games. Then you skyrocketed up to around 44% over the next 12 games. Mm-hmm. Then dipped back down over the last five games to around 33%. What was behind that streakiness this year? Is there any reason for it when you kind of self-assess the way this year went?
Yeah. I mean, going to Tennessee, like we were very judicious on the threes we took. We were like bottom of the country in amount of threes attempted or whatever, spot up threes. We try to play more through the post and the bigs. And I think in the beginning of the year, I was kind of thinking about, you know, when's a good time to shoot it, like on the catch. But then that good streak I had, I was just kind of playing, you know, if it's open three, I'm shooting it. Even there's a defender in front of me. And then, I mean, the last half of the season was kind of tough. I was dealing with the injury and had to sit out a lot of like a couple weeks for practice and just trying to get back my rhythm. But I mean, ultimately it was just, you know, learning our system, the process, reading my teammates.
I mean, speaking about injuries, in that second game, I believe, against Alabama, it looked like you tore your ACL.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah.
And you came back in that. What was the story behind that?
So I went down. The defender kind of rolled up under me. Pretty much, I mean, to sum it up, like a sprained knee, high ankle sprain, both those things. So I tried to come back in the same game. Just couldn't run right, so it was hard. But they sat me out for 2 games. I wanted to come back earlier, but it's kind of smart that I didn't. So I was able to kind of play in the NCAA tournament and SEC tournament too.
I mean, I'm curious about like the fight to come back in the middle of that game. Were coaches trying to get you not to come back, or were you just like pushing to come back? I'm good. Or what was the conversation like?
So we had, after the injury, had went back. They kind of assessed me, and I looked stable. And then I just kind of like, I think I'm good. So I went back, and then they saw me like running terribly, limping all over the place. So they pulled me out, went back to the training room. I was like, I asked them just to slap more tape on it so I can come back in. But they were like, nah, we're going to sit you down for the rest of the game. And it was super frustrating because that was like a critical point of our season, like going into SC tournament. If we were to win that game, I think we would have clinched the 4 seed. So you get like a double bye. So, I mean, for me, it was just working back as quick as I could so we can get that double bye. And then we end up losing to Vanderbilt again, the last home game of the season, so we couldn't get it. But I just feel like, whenever you can play, even if it's you're not 100%, I think you should. And luckily for me, the injury wasn't too bad. So
I'm curious, like, I think one of the critiques people in the NBA might have around you is they say, oh, he's not tough. He doesn't have toughness. That feels like an example of toughness that you can look back on and say, I'm proud of the way I performed in that moment trying to play. Are there any other stories that come to mind when you kind of look back at your history, whether in high school or last year at Tennessee, where you're like, yeah, I've proved to myself that I'm tough, that I can perform in those moments?
Definitely. I remember in high school, we were playing a summer league game, which didn't matter at all. And then my teammate had slashed my eyebrow, then broke my nose, and I was bleeding all over the place. And then it stitched me up, and I kind of went right back in a game, and it went to overtime. We ended up getting the win. But I mean, there's plenty of stories like that from Tennessee, like rolling my ankle and coming back in, playing during practice or whatever. I just think if a team doesn't think I'm tough, I just don't think they've really watched me or know me as a person in general. I think that's like one of the biggest insults in all sports, is to get called soft. So something I definitely wear with a chip on my shoulder.
What else do scouts get wrong about you?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, at the soft, just because of my frame, I think sometimes it can misunderstand like soft spokenness or not being the loudest one in the room as someone who's not confident or someone who's not, the most confident in the room. I just think that like it couldn't be further from the truth. I am, super tough, super confident in any situation I'm in.
Now, I think with you, like, I think we talked earlier briefly, you entered at 185. Now you're at 210. What's the target weight for you in like the peak of your career physically?
I don't know, honestly. I think what I kind of learned at Tennessee, when I first came in that first summer, I was on a crazy diet, and like I put on 20 pounds pretty fast. And I think like putting on just aimless pounds it doesn't do anything for you. I think for me, I want to put on weight, but also just like learn how to control that weight, have power in that weight. So not really a target weight, but definitely want to get stronger and add on pounds.
Was there any like, did it sap you of your burst at all, you think, adding that weight so quickly?
Maybe. I think more of it was just like eating so much food before practice. You feel terrible, like you got to throw up before a game and stuff like that. But I mean, it was fine. Like my strength coach did a good job of kind of helped me understand my body more.
Has it maintained now? Like you're like not having to force food down at this point?
I'm trying to do that, but like I'm trying to enjoy my food now too. I'm not trying to be.
Well, you're in New York City, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What's the best food you've had out here?
We went to what was the spot we went to yesterday? San Ambrose. That place is fire.
What was there? What's that?
It's Italian. I'm a big Italian guy. I love Italian food.
You're Italian?
I'm not Italian. I have Italian citizenship. My mom is technically, but
so you have Italian and you're Italian. I'm a quarter Italian.
Yeah.
So I love Italian. You like red sauce Italian or like some of the other type of Italian?
I mean all types of Italian, really.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I just like the red sauce, like chicken parm. I'm like meatballs. I'm very basic.
Yeah.
That's the type of Italian I like. I'm dieting now though. You've gained 25. I've lost 20 pounds. I'm trying to lose like 30 more. So you can take some of that. I mean, with the strength aspect, I'm curious, Nate. I would imagine that's going to help you when it comes to getting the basket, getting to the rim. You shot 43% on layups this year in the half court, according to Synergy Sports. At 6'10", that's obviously not a great number. Right. What do you contribute to that low percentage at the rim this year?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make a bunch of excuses. I mean, the percentage is what it is. I think, again, like our style of play made it a little bit difficult to get to the rim, especially over, you know, we had two bigs in the paint, so you're finishing really over, you know, there's four people in there. You got to make a lot of quick decisions in a short amount of time. But I mean, like for me, I'm just excited again for this, like going to the NBA, different style of play, kind of, you know, more space to work with, but also just like, that is definitely a room for improvement. It's something I got to get better at for sure. And that's what we've been working on. I'm not saying it's going to get easier as we get to NBA, like you said, going against Wemby and bigger guys for sure, but it's going to be more of a, you know, beat your defender and you got a one-on-one with the big. And I think that would be a little bit easier than kind of what it was this year.
I think it's a good perspective, honestly, because it's like not many NBA teams are running with two players on the floor that don't shoot at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it's just the reality of the situation. Obviously, defenders are better. They're bigger. They're longer. They're quicker. Mm-hmm. But it's just a completely different style of play. And I'm saying that as somebody, I love Felix Okpara.
Yeah.
I think he's a really talented prospect. I'm sure you love him too.
Yeah.
But like, it's just the college style versus the NBA style. You mentioned things you are working on when it comes to at-rim finishing. What are some of those technical things that you are trying to improve?
Yeah, playing lower. It's like if you want to, especially if you want to be a guard in the NBA and having guards guard, you got to be able to play lower than them. Playing through physicality, through bumps, and finishing over bigger defenders. So then also just more consistently shooting into my spots, making those, and also catch and shoot, being able to shoot that at a higher rate.
I think anytime it comes to draft scouting, you can look at the college film. It's like a 30-something game sample in many cases. And then you have to look at the high school stuff to feel how a player progressed, but also how they performed in a different environment. With you, I think back to your game in the Hoopall Classic against Aaron Peterson. You had 22-11-4 that game, drew a foul late in the game, hit two clutch free throws to put your team up. And then on the other end of the floor, you just completely swallowed up Aaron Peterson on his drive. He got called for an offensive foul. You guys win the game. It showed off your two-way ability and your clutch scoring ability. What do you remember from that game in the Hoopall Classic against Peterson?
If I'm honest, I don't really remember much in the game. I just remember celebrating with my teammates after. It meant a lot, just not even like for me, but like you go back to the small city in Virginia we're from, and it's in the newspaper that we beat like the number one team. So that was super dope. But I think that game was just a super competitive game. Like if you want to see like a toughness aspect or, you know, someone who wants to compete, I think you watch that game. Darren was coming at us the whole game and you know, a lot of respect for him and who he is as a player. So I think just watching that battle of me and him and our team against his team was great. But I mean, it just meant so much for our team in our city.
I mentioned that play at the end where he got called for the offensive foul. You're just sliding with him, really mirroring his movements well. What? How do you assess yourself today as a defensive player, and how do you view yourself long term as a player on the defensive end of the floor?
I think that's another room, like for improvement for me. I think, especially going into the draft, a lot of people think about their offensive capabilities, like growing their game that way. But that's something huge. I think that can earn me a lot more minutes than the offense can in the league when I get there. But I think like, going back to that game and where I've grown from at my year at Tennessee, obviously Tennessee is one of the best defensive teams in the country. A lot of more technical stuff like you were talking about, like chasing people over screens, getting over a ball screen, talking, being in the right position all the time, hitting bodies on a box out, like stuff you don't really get coached on a lot is what Coach Barnes coached us on. So stuff like that, and also just, you know, on-ball defense and keeping the man in front of you.
Now, I mentioned those clutch free throws this season in college basketball. According to CBB Analytics, you had 97 points scored in the clutch, one of the highest amounts in the league, including one of the highest points per game in clutch time this past season. Is that a time that you feel comfortable? What is it about the performance that you've had in some of those tighter games down the stretch?
100%. I think like clutch time is when I want the ball the most. Like, I think I can, if I, you know, shoot a shot to win the game and I miss, I can live with that, knowing I gave it a shot, I gave it an attempt. It just goes back to like when I first fell in love with the game, like playing out in the park with my brother and my friends. Everybody wanted the game winning shot. So I think for me, it's something I love. Like I kind of love that pressure. I seek it out. And it's really not any pressure just because it's, you know, it's just another shot, something I worked on. And make or miss is something I can live with, like I said. But Yeah, I mean, I love being in those moments and kind of maybe not having a possibility like write history and stuff like that. It just means so much and something I seek out for sure.
We mentioned earlier that OKC workout you had where it was just you there and you got worked hard for that one. I've heard through a couple people I've talked to is that there's a big group workout that the Nets are having with you and a bunch of other lottery guys, and then one that the Bulls are having with a bunch of guys in your similar range. Mm-hmm. What are you going to be looking to prove in those group workout situations?
Yeah, I think, like, to be honest, going into those workouts, I'm not, you know, looking to prove much. I think just show what I've been working on in this offseason, but also just like, I think competing is the number one thing. I think, you know, those NBA execs already have enough film on everyone that they need. So they just want to see us in a competition setting. You know, how can we compete? But I'm just excited to be like playing with some of the best guys in this draft, like players I'm probably going to be seeing for the next couple of years in the league. Those are things I'm excited about. And in the pre-draft process, you don't go like live a lot just to, you know, kind of protect your body, but like ramping it back up and being able to go live against, you know, really good players is something I'm super excited for.
Your year began with an exhibition game against Duke. You went 5-for-19 in that game, had an air ball. Year ended in the Elite Eight against Michigan, 7 points on 2 of 12, fouled out in 31 minutes. What do you say to NBA teams that might say he didn't have his best performances against the best competition?
I mean, I didn't. If you look at it, I didn't. Shout out to those guys, tremendous teams, but I think, yeah, like it was tough. Came in and played my first game against Duke and didn't have the best game. And then to end of the year, didn't have the best game. But I think just like it's case by case, honestly. Like you play two really good teams and you're head of the scout. It's tough. It is. But I think there's, you know, walking away from those games and seeing from the beginning of the year where I played Duke and I've, you know, grown ever since then. Then also we got our teeth kicked in by Michigan, but you know they're one of the best teams. So
everybody did.
Those guys. Yeah, literally.
They got three potential lottery guys on that team. What did you learn from that? I'm curious. Yeah. I'm sure you probably watched it back, right?
Yeah, of course. It's a lot of stuff that I just could take away from what we did this year. A lot of stuff that maybe I probably won't see in my next couple of years in the league, but that's a very similar like team you'll see in the NBA. Like all five guys can get off the glass and push it. Play very fast in the full court. And then, you know, they played really well in the half court together too. Like with Yaxel, he was so good in transition and he could shoot the ball really well. So that's kind of just like a taste of what I probably will be seeing in the next couple of years and something I got to adapt to. But mostly like just taking away from the defensive side rather than the offensive side, like guarding these guys, guarding, you know, Elliot Cadeau, the point guard, then also guarding Yaxel, their three, then also guarding Ade Mara. They're five. Like those are things I'm probably going to be seeing in the next couple of years.
Trey McKinney next year's draft. I mean, it's just endless with that Michigan team. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny with you. Like you enter the year, people say, I mean, Nate Amendt, you know, oh, could he be the number one? And then the year is up and down for you in Tennessee, and yet you guys make the Elite Eight, mm-hmm. right? It was a success, and you still average nearly 20 points per game. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about kind of the public reaction to performance this year compared to what your expectations were going in and how it resulted?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's a great thing, honestly. Like people can look at the year and say I haven't performed great, but I still average 17 points a game. Like that's still something. If you can average 17 points a game and you're still not performing well, then I mean, like the sky's the limit, and there's no telling to what I could average or how I could perform in years to come. So I think that's honestly a plus. But to answer the second part of the question, like being your own worst critic can be bad at sometimes. That's what I was kind of for myself. I was someone who didn't really like appreciate my game just because I put so much pressure on myself to succeed, to lead my team. But I mean, at the end of the day, it just comes down, you know, to winning. So like we were able to get what we wanted to get done. We were trying to, of course, give Tennessee their first Final Four appearance. We couldn't do it. But in that process, we won a lot of games and we got to lead eight while doing it.
I'm curious about your experience playing in the U18s with Acuff, Michael Brown, a lot of, you know, ball handlers, guys who have it in their hands a lot. What did you learn about being in a role where you weren't necessarily the guy with the ball in your hands all the time?
Yeah. I learned a lot, not even just about that, like, because I didn't really get any minutes during that U18 run. You know, I thought I was the best player on the team, but not everyone views myself in the same light. So that's kind of something I realized. Also just realizing like, you know, how many minutes I get or how much I play I can't change that. I can't affect that. So for me, just how can I show up and support my teammates? How can I get better every single day? That's what I learned. But again, just learning, like, those guys are so good at creating offense. So sometimes you don't have to do too much with the ball. Like, you get the ball and you're open, shoot it. You don't got to, you know, play with it too much. And that's kind of something, you know, again, something similar we're going to see when I get to the league next year.
If you could download a specific move from another player and it's installed overnight and you have it, what would that move be?
Like one specific move?
One specific move.
Oof.
People have mentioned like Harden step back, SGA's body control. I interviewed Wemby a few years ago and he talked about kind of a pause that KD used when he would curl around a screen or a handoff in order to like get the defender a little bit off balance. Could be micro skills like that or kind of trademark skills that players have. Anything that comes to mind?
I would say like Cade Cunningham's patience. Like when he gets into the lane, he's super patient with the ball. He's never rushed, and that's kind of tough for being like a bigger point guard with smaller guards getting up under you. So definitely his patience coming off ball screens, seeing the defense, or Chris Ball's IQ. Like he knows the game in and out, knows where every player is on the court. So that's something I would take.
I like the Chris Paul answer more.
Yeah,
Pistons fans aren't too happy with me this year because I've been critical of Cade. Sometimes really? Too casual, a little too casual with the ball. I mean, I like the calmness. I like calm Cade. I don't like casual Cade.
Yeah,
that's big difference there. I'm curious, what was your first encounter with basketball, Nate?
Oof. If I'm being honest, my first encounter was kind of sour because I went to the court with my brother after being told like we couldn't try out for the soccer team. So I was just super sad. I was like crying my eyes out. And then we went to go play basketball, and then I soon after found my love for it. But my first encounters were always just at the park, like growing up all the way until probably like my sophomore year of high school. We were just always outside at our local elementary school park, playing on 3-on-3, 5-on-5, 4-on-4, whatever it is, but just like competing every day outside.
So you played soccer growing up.
Mm-hmm.
That was like kind of your first love playing sports.
Absolutely.
I say, why didn't they let you work out? Too tall or something?
Nah. Yeah, I don't even know what happened at the end of the day. We went to the tryout and they were just like, I can't try out today. So
where do you get your height from?
Probably my dad. He's around 6'7".
Okay, 6'7". He played college basketball, right? Mm-hmm. Is he a Hall of Famer, I heard?
Is he that is, true? D2 at Wayne State.
Wow, and he played with Scott Perry, mm-hmm. Kings GM?
Yeah, he did.
Wow, what a connection.
It was crazy. I remember... we go to the draft lottery, like to go see what teams are picked. And then I see him come up. He introduces himself as like an exec for the Kings. I'm like, all right. And then he comes up and gives my dad a huge hug. I'm like, what's going on here? How do you guys know each other? He's like, we played together. I was like, oh, wow, that's crazy.
Your dad was the better player too, right?
I think so.
I mean, I don't know if Scott Perry's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
I saw your dad is.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool, right? What was his style of play?
Oof. He was like a power forward, but he could really shoot it. I heard he was really good in the mid range, really good free throw shooter. But he was also kind of like a tough, snotty nose type of player, like get all the offensive rebounds and do the dirty work.
Did your dad not really like force basketball on you at a young age?
Not at all, really.
So it came to you naturally then.
Yeah, with my brother, you know, going to play at the park with him, but I mean, he never really forced any sports on us.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like it's such a different experience compared to some kids entering the league who have parents that played. They'd put the ball in their hands, yeah. Saying, dribble.
Yeah, literally.
Remember, you see that video of Jalen Brunson, his father, right?
Yeah, shooting a bunch of pull-ups.
Different approaches to parenting, right?
Actually, speaking about Jalen Brunson, I heard they're not too happy with you either.
Oh, I know. I left him off my All-NBA team. I'm a dope. I mean, look, here's the thing. It's a regular season award.
Yeah.
And I thought Maxey had the better two-way year.
Okay.
And I was in the wrong there.
Yeah.
I had two Knicks guys on the podcast on Thursday.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Macri, who runs a great, great Knicks site, Knicks Film School, he said to me, where you miss most, he's like, you can talk about the stats, you can talk about the defense, but Brunson, the edge with his leadership and what he does to define the culture of the team.
Definitely.
And I think he's right.
Yeah.
I undervalued that.
Mm.
I did when it came to that vote. And I'm sure like for you being in locker rooms, you see the importance of that, right?
Sure. I think the locker room is the biggest aspect of the whole thing. Like if a team's not together on or off the court, then like it's hard to really be together when it's time to win. But like having a leader there, having someone like you can look to when something's going wrong or something, or you know, like the game's on the line, having someone you can look to means like all the difference. Just provides you with so much more comfort and allows you to relax when it's time to win.
Are you more of a leader by example than vocally?
I would say so. I would say I'm definitely not afraid to speak up, especially in a team setting, like during the game. There's many times like we were in a huddle and I would speak up for the whole team and call plays for us. But I definitely, I mean, I think leading by example is the best way to do it, to be honest. But I'm not afraid to speak up when it's needed.
Who are some NBA players you compare yourself to or you maybe idolized growing up?
I idolized KD a lot. Compare myself to him too. Like I love his game. I try to, you know, resemble it as much as I can. I like Cade Cunningham a lot. I love watching his game. I like watching a lot of the big guards like Cade Cunningham, Tyrese Halliburton, some of those guys. And I'm a big fan of Paul George and even Carmelo Anthony, just how he operates in the mid range and how he scores so efficiently.
Does it matter? Do you get drafted high?
No, not really. I think just for me, like you hear a lot of players say, just like the fit, you know, if I can stay there for, I don't want to be a person that is kind of moving from team to team all the time. I want to stay at one team for like my whole career if it's up to me. So I think just like finding that team and being able to build with it.
I have some random questions for you to close us out in here, Nate. What's your biggest motivator?
I mean, at my size, like having the skill set I have, being blessed like by God with the height and the skill set, I think it's just like a way for me to honor God and my relationship with him is just to maximize my potential and what he's given me.
What's your biggest pet peeve?
Oof. Basketball or not? Like
anything. Or both. You give both.
My biggest pet peeve. Oh. For basketball, I hate when people wear black socks. Really? I don't like black socks. Especially with white shoes. Like black socks, white shoes is not it.
Well, that's a mismatch.
Yeah. Maybe all black.
I don't even have style, but I wouldn't even do that. Unless it's my last pair of socks, no excuse.
Yeah, right. That's all I got for right now.
Okay, so black socks and white shoes. What's some music that you like that might surprise some people?
I literally like every type of music, like Olivia Dean, Zach Bryan, R&B, hip hop, rap. Like I listen to Brazilian type music, French music. My dad's a French teacher, so I listen to some French music, Italian music, all of it.
You speak any French at all?
No.
He never taught you?
Never taught me, no.
Did you not want to learn?
I mean, I did, but like I feel like if after you're like a baby and they're not speaking it to you, then I'm not learning that. Yeah. Like I took Spanish in high school. That's what I kind of learned a little bit. But yeah, no.
Father that teaches French and you're like, I'm taking Spanish.
My older brother took French thinking that my dad would help him with homework and like like get him an easy A, but that was further from the case. He got like a D. So it was like, I'm not doing that.
Music. How about Pink Floyd?
Pink Floyd?
You don't know Pink Floyd? Interview's over. No, I'm just kidding. You don't know Pink Floyd? How about, I don't know, like Led Zeppelin? Like classic. Yeah, okay, you know Led Zeppelin, but not Pink Floyd. Interesting.
What era is that?
Like 1970s.
I do like music back, like older music like that. Like even older, like I think Marty Robbins is it or something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, like even like with at Tennessee, Coach Barnes would put me onto some older songs. Oh, yeah? He's like super ancient, but it was great.
You don't know like Dark Side of the Moon?
No.
You don't know Dark Side of the Moon? That album cover with the triangle and the rainbow. You don't know that?
I've seen the album cover. I don't know. Who is that?
That's Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. You got to give that album a listen with some headphones on. Right. Just nice headphones, your best pair, and just 38 minutes or something like that. Right. Just relax. you'll feel good. What's your weirdest habit?
My weirdest habit? Put me on the spot. I don't even know. My weirdest habit? I don't think I have.
Not listening to Pink Floyd. What do you do besides basketball?
I like playing like every sport. Me and my brother just got into tennis. I love watching soccer. Huge Arsenal fan. We just won the league. So that's huge. Golf even, stuff like that.
So you're like a sports guy. You're not watching TV much or anything like that? Movies? No.
I don't even like watch that many different sports. Like I'd rather go out and play the sport than watch it.
That's interesting. I see. You've watched a lot of the playoffs though, aside from the game you attended to. Definitely. I see. What has stood out to you in these postseason?
Just it's super physical. Like you can see, well, it's not decided by the refs, but a lot of times like you're putting a lot of pressure on the refs to call certain things. Especially in this OKC and Spurs here, just you know, physical every possession. I could see like in the regular season they could call a foul every possession. So you gotta be super physical to be able to play in the playoffs.
And last question, Nate, what do you love most about the game of basketball?
I love the competition aspect of it. I think basketball is like the most intimate game in the world. Like, I have the ball and you want it, and I'm not going to let you take it. And then also just like the person in front of you is the only one stopping you from winning the game. So I think that's like one of the most intimate things, you know, about the game. And then also just like competing every single day. And it's just, you know, super, super fun sport to play, and you can play it, you know, literally anywhere. And, you know, what I've learned this past year, like going to Rwanda and stuff like that, like you can use the game in so many different ways. You can use it to change lives, change, you know, the trajectory of a country. So I think that's, you know, something that's super underestimated about the game.
I mean, you mentioned competing every day. Like, that's what you're doing right now, the feeling of progress, right?
For sure.
That's a big part. Well, Nate, I'm rooting for you, man. I look forward to seeing how these next few weeks go for you and what's beyond in the NBA.
Sir,
congrats, and wishing you all the best, man.
Appreciate it.
Thank you to Nate Amen for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to the whole Yahoo staff for producing today's show. A lot of work remotely and in New York City putting today's show together. Be sure to listen to my Knicks podcast with CP the Franchise and Jonathan Macri if you missed that one. That posted on early Thursday. Heavy Knicks talk in that one. I'll be back again, I believe, on Saturday night, after game 7 between the Spurs and the Thunder. I cannot wait. Have a good night, everybody.